Magazine. Hello, Capital Region. This is Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm Lavonia Mallory.
And I'm Guy Schaefer. Today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, Elizabeth Press conducts another interview with Sarah Rogerson as they discussed Kinimo Negron case, who was released from ICE detention this week. After that, Lavonia Mallory continues her discussion with Dr. Tracy Parker in another Reclaiming History segment entitled The Department Store and the Freedom Movement. And then we have another Climate Matters segment with Peter Savio, who talks to Eleanor Stein, adjunct professor at Albany Law School, about the last 10 years of significant policy and legal responses to the challenges presented by increasing levels of climate. Then we have another Cassidy McCabe segment entitled The Spirit of the Suffragettes with Deborah LaFond, Barbara Sutton, and Shelby Mack. And then finally, Alexis Goldsmith speaks with Assemblyperson William Colton and Alex Beecham of Food and Water Watch about the New York Off Fossil Fuels Bill.
But first, let's have some headlines, Guy.
Let's do that, Lavonia. The 7th Annual Freedom Festival is going to be held on Saturday, June 8th from 3 to 6 p.m., and then will be held in Freedom Square every Tuesday at 4 to 7 p.m. from July 16th through August 20th, closing with the 9th Annual Story Harvest Celebration in early September.
President Donald Trump's former lawyer, Michael Cohen, filed a lawsuit Thursday claiming the Trump organization broke a promise to pay his legal bills and owes at least $1.9 million to cover the cost of his defense.
Albany County is weighing settlement of a lawsuit filed by a former inmate who says she was forced to give birth while illegally shackled at a local hospital. The county legislature on Monday will consider paying $150,000 to Rensselaer County resident Dawn Mann, who was restrained while giving birth at St. Peter's Hospital in 2014. The practice of shackling incarcerated women during childbirth has been heavily criticized, yet cases of women giving birth while restrained in some fashion continue throughout the country. In 2009, New York banned the restraining of pregnant inmates during labor, delivery, and postpartum recovery. Despite the practice being outlawed, allegations have surfaced that it still occurs in New York.
Albany Mayor Kathy Sheehan has announced the City of Albany's Poverty Reduction Initiative. CAPRI is entering a new phase. The program is partnering with Albany Medical Center, St. Peter's Health Partners, and CARES of New York to provide not only jobs, but also affordable child care and transportation for people who work unconventional hours. Kathy Sheehan said, "Our hope is if we can establish routes that aren't on the public bus line, that maybe employers with some incentives will operate their own transportation for workers." I think that's it, Guy. That's all I got. For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to WOOC's Hudson Mohawk Magazine on 105.3 FM, The Sanctuary.
To learn more about this program and how to support The Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or warm regards, you can text us at 518-888-888. 3004.
So, Guy, do you have a riddle today?
Not yet. Okay. But maybe I'll come up with one.
Think hard. Okay. Up next, we have a interview by Elizabeth Press, another excellent interview with Sarah Rogerson, as they discuss Kinimo Negron's case, who was released from ICE detention this week. Hudson Mohawk.
Today, I'm joined by.
And so here she goes.
Sarah Rogerson. She is the director of the Immigration Law Clinic at the Albany Law School. She was also part of the team that represented Kinimo Negron, a local man who had been held in ICE custody for the past 6 weeks and was just released on Tuesday. Sarah, welcome back to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Thanks for having me.
On Wednesday, there was a heartfelt welcome home for Kinimo Negron. Before he was released, we spoke to Kinimo's wife, Lisa. But can you remind us of his story and tell us about Kinimo Negron's case from a more legal standpoint?
Sure. He came to the United States over a decade ago, we believe, through Philadelphia. The thing about immigration is that it's very opaque, and they don't provide immigrants with the documentation that they've accumulated over the years. And so part of what we're doing is piecing together the puzzle of Kinimo's case. But we do know that he was fleeing unrest in his home country. We believe that he articulated what's called a credible fear when he arrived here, which is the beginning of the asylum process. And then his asylum case wound through the system over a series of years, and it gets very fuzzy as to what happened to that claim. He finds his way up to the Capital District. He started actually working in the Bowery Mission in New York City. So he's been working to feed the homeless this whole time. He wound his way up to Albany, and as is the story for many immigrant families, he meets somebody, they fall in love, and they start a family together. And his wife, Lisa, was a big part of his immigration story because once they were married, there were other avenues of immigration relief available to him. A lot of people think that's automatic. You marry a U.S. citizen and you're in. But that's not how it works. And it's certainly not how it worked for Kanimo because immigration sat on their application for about 2 years. Those applications are supposed to be adjudicated pretty quickly, and his wasn't. And unfortunately for him and for the community, when he went to present himself to immigration, which he was required to do a periodic check-in without warning, they snatched him up and sent him 4 hours away. So that's when we engaged.
And does that typically happen that, you know, you go in for a check-in, you've been going in for your check-ins, and then all of a sudden, what happens in that moment where they decide, we need to detain you now? Do you understand what changes with ICE in that moment?
No, and it happens a lot, and it's happening with increasing frequency. And that's why two of the lawyers on our team actually are specializing in what they call guerrilla habeas. Habeas is a legal term for basically the body. You're trying to make sure that somebody's body is where it's supposed to be and that it's not in the custody of the state. So it's usually a surprise to these individuals when this happens. Hardly anybody knows that they're going to be picked up. And that's why a lot of community groups have come around these accompaniment programs to make sure that there are eyes and ears around when folks go to their check-in to observe what happens. But that's all that can be done. Kanimo checked in with his minister and his attorney. He was separated from them. They were told they were no longer involved in the process, and he was taken to a separate room. This happens all the time. And as I said, every day with increasing frequency, where people are just disappeared from our community.
Scary. You rallied a team to represent Kanimo. Can you tell us a little bit about that process?
Yeah. So increasingly, immigration lawyers are getting more and more well connected to each other. I think it's one of those when crisis hits and when it's been hitting for so long, it's like every 3 months we have another immigration crisis. We all know each other. I've worked with my friend Camille Mackler at the New York Immigration Coalition to network the state. And when something like this happens, we have listservs that we can send out to and say, hey, does anybody specialize? This is what we know about the case. This is where it's going to be venued. Is there anybody who has time to pitch in? Cases like Kanimo's are so intricate and complicated that you really need at least 5 lawyers, which seems bizarre and crazy, but that's the way it is. So we had a team of 2, Gregory Copeland and Sarah Gilman from New Sanctuary Coalition Community Defense. They're a new group, a new nonprofit who have really, like I said, taken on these guerrilla habeas cases. On their way back from Kanimo's case last week, they actually ended up filing a petition from their car using their hotspot, had a telephonic appearance, and ended up getting their client pulled off of a plane where he was about to be deported. Because Kanimo was detained in Batavia, the Western District of New York had jurisdiction over his case. So Gregory and Sarah are in the Southern District of New York because they're New York City based. So I called up Nicole Hallett at Buffalo Law School in January when he was detained. And so that's right around when clinics are selecting their cases for the students. And then my students worked on the stuff that gets processed here in the Latham USCIS office, Citizenship and Immigration Services. And that's his visa application and all the other applications that go with it. That's the team, and that's how it sort of sorted itself out. And then we had local counsel, Fred Korkos, who had been representing Kanimo this whole time, getting his employment documents squared away, filed the initial application on behalf of Kanimo and Lisa, and was like waiting for immigration to process it. When you put it all together and you see like 6 lawyers and 8 law students, how does it take that much, never mind the thousands of community members that were involved? I mean, we had a petition that circulated through ICE Free Capital District, and it received over 2,000 signatures. That's insane. And to have the support of city government and county government and the New York State Legislature, and then the lieutenant governor is at the press conference. Not every single case gets that kind of attention, which is really too bad that that's what's required in order to successfully navigate the immigration system. That's how crazy it is.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the widespread support. That brought a lot of attention to this case, one of them being Albany County Sheriff Craig Apple. He called for immigration reform, saying that this story should be a call for that. What is he talking about? What would that reform look like?
Yeah, so the sheriff actually is one of the heroes of this story. He arranges for donations of food to the Capital City Rescue Mission. So he was calling Perry, the director of the mission, just to arrange a food drop-off, and that's when he found out about Kanimo's case. One thing is, you know, getting rid of mandatory detention. There are circumstances under which people are required to be detained, and it has nothing to do whether they're violent or nonviolent. It doesn't have to do with whether they broke any criminal laws. It's typically for certain civil violations of our immigration laws, and they're stuck in detention. And then you have the conditions in these detention facilities. You have private companies running detention facilities, and immigration officers are civilians. They're civil law enforcement officers. They're not trained like police officers, and there are lots of problems with the police, right? We can hold both of these truths together. But the sheriff has tried to create this culture, even in the jail, where it's kind of a tough sell because of our criminal justice system and the way that even people who work within that system are conditioned by the work to be less than compassionate. But now I'm getting into criminal justice reform. And when we do talk about immigration reform, we have to talk about criminal justice reform, because part of those systems link together in really damaging and dangerous ways. So the detention conditions and the mandatory detention policies are an easy win. I mean, they're expensive. It costs a lot of money to house people. It's unnecessary, and they could be out pursuing lawful immigration status, and you shouldn't have to wait in detention. Our immigration system was built on, frankly, racist policies from the very beginning. I mean, we've always, some of the earliest laws, you talk about the Chinese Exclusion Act, literally, categorically excluding people from citizenship. So comprehensive immigration reform is really going to involve changing the very roots of a system that's designed to exclude the quote-unquote undesirables of the day. I read an article this morning that says that they're going to freeze the training of immigration judges and stop hiring them. That's the actual opposite reform that we're looking for. More judges, more asylum officers, more resources dedicated not towards punishment, towards allowing children to die in immigration detention, towards arming an untrained civilian force to snatch people off of our streets, but arming the system that is in place, the system of laws that allow people to process through the immigration, through the legal way, quote unquote. Why aren't we staffing up those systems and processes? Like I said, judges, mental health professionals, asylum officers, visa processors, you know, these are all civil servants who are trying to do their best, and they've got a crushing, crushing workload. There are immigration judges that are just walking off the bench. So we're a long ways off. Immigration is obviously politically charged. We're not in a friendly political environment for immigration reform. And unfortunately, the political winds really have to change in order for that to be meaningful. On the local level, I think what the sheriff is talking about is slowing down or resisting cooperation with immigration officials whenever possible and at whatever turn possible. We currently have in New York State a bill pending called the Protect Our Courts Act that would limit ICE's access to any state courthouses so that victims, when they're going to seek an order of protection in family court, aren't picked up if they're undocumented. Things like that. There are little things that can be done.
You know, we've talked to Delilah Yeend, and I assume her case and Kanimo Nagoran's case are sort of the exception to the rule. What do you know numbers here in the Capital Region about people detained and people who are then not released?
Well, it's harder for us to get detained numbers from Batavia. It's not transparent whatsoever. In Albany County, right now it hovers around 3 to 5 people. Not asylum seekers generally. Those are folks who are picked up locally for immigration violations. I don't know how much longer that's going to last in terms of that being an option. But last summer, we ended up, you know, we had over 350 folks. Those have all been, all of those people were processed. They were, they all saw lawyers, and over 90% of them passed their credible fear interview as a result of being connected to lawyers, and none of them are left at the jail. It's harder to wrap our arms around the full population. There are a couple of other local jails. We have no idea the numbers in Rensselaer County. We know people are being held in Rensselaer County, but that information has not been forthcoming.
Just to end, what happens with Kanimo Nagoran now?
Kanimo has an ankle monitor, and he's being monitored daily by immigration, which we believe is totally unnecessary. And we're working on his visa application process. There's a lot that's involved. He has a lot of hurdles left. He's going to need almost every single member of his legal team for the foreseeable future until we're successful in getting him a green card and on the path to citizenship.
That was Elizabeth Press interviewing Sarah Rogerson. You can catch Sarah on a panel at Albany Law on Detention Monday, March 11th.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM, The Sanctuary.
Next up, Livonia Mallory continues her discussion with Dr. Tracy Parker in another Reclaiming History segment entitled The Department Store and the Freedom Movement. Dr. Tracy Parker is an assistant professor of Afro-American Studies at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. Parker is currently completing her book manuscript entitled Workers, Consumers, and Civil Rights.
Once again, we have another episode of Reclaiming History. We have a very special guest with us today. Dr. Tracy Parker is an assistant professor of Afro-American Studies at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. She received her PhD in history from the University of Chicago in 2013. Professor Parker is currently completing her book manuscript entitled Workers, Consumers, and Civil Rights, Workers, Consumers, and the Civil Rights. She examines the movement of racially integration of white-collar jobs and consumerism in the American department store industry. Dr. Parker is arguably the number one historian in this area.
So last time, Dr. Parker, we were talking about the department stores. Can you tell us a little bit more about the world of the department store during the early freedom movement? Or shall I say during the civil rights movement?
It's hard for, I think, people to imagine nowadays what department stores actually look like before, you know, maybe the 1980s. These were really large buildings that took up a block, sometimes blocks of a city, and they had everything in them. So you could get your hair done. You could get your nails done. You could have, they typically had a nursery in early department stores where these white middle class women would drop off their children and then spend the day shopping. You would eat. There were piano players. There were jazz musicians. The idea was that you were supposed to enter the department store if you're a white middle class woman and you stay all day.
Sounds like a spa.
That's exactly right. You know? It's supposed to be sort of like the club for women.
And so African-Americans were in that environment, but they were second-class citizens within this imaginary world of the department store.
Yes. So typically African-Americans were hired as janitors, elevator operators, cooks, and maids. They're in positions where either you are not seen at all because you're behind the scenes, or you are, as in the case of elevator operators, you're seen, but you're not supposed to speak. You're not supposed to be heard. You're supposed to be invisible.
So you're the servant within this.
You're the servant, yeah. And for African Americans, I should note that this is an improvement from what many of them can get, right? So if you're an African American woman, specifically, you would be relegated to domestic work. And being in someone's home in close proximity to a white person could be very stressful. It could be dangerous. There are cases of many sexual abuses, of physical abuse of black maids. And so in the department store, there's some safety, and you're making a bit more money.
Now, my mother, she's going to be 82 this year. She talks about only certain high yellow, and for people who are not from the South and may not understand what that means, that's an African-American woman or person who is fair-skinned, you know, like the brown paper bag. So they had to be brighter or lighter than a brown paper bag, and they would be considered high yellow. So she talks about only high yellow women being able to get jobs in the department store and how their hair had to be, you know, pressed. They couldn't have, you know, there was no such thing as an Afro-wearing department store worker. Your hair was pressed, you were light complexion, and if you were working in the department store, and she often talks about a particular woman who was the first black woman in the town that she grew up in to work in the department store. And she worked in, like, the candy area where they sold candy. And that was a big deal in her mind.
Yes, so you're right. I mean, a lot of the early ones who are going to integrate are definitely light skin, and they have more white features, and they have a closer proximity to the white community. And oftentimes, this is strategic on the part of African-American activists, because they understand that store owners are reluctant to integrate, and so those who are willing to do it want to do it where perhaps the black person's not very noticeable. And so in placing them in departments like candy is a space where it might be, especially because it's food, it's acceptable for her to sell food. Now, they would never place a black woman in that time, in the early times, in, like, let's say lingerie, because black people are said to racially contaminate things, right? The idea was that black people were dirty and carried certain diseases that could be transmitted to white people. So there's certain departments that they, when they first integrate, that they're hired in. And African Americans, oftentimes when, you know, a department store could have one black person and a sales job, and the black community throughout the country would know. It would be published in the Chicago Defender, the Baltimore Afro-American, right? These are black newspapers, prominent black newspapers, and it was celebrated as a look at the success and the progress of the race. And it's sort of because hopeful for what they thought was going to come.
Because you were working in a department store.
Because you were working in a department store, and everything that the department store was supposed to feel like, it feels like a amusement, right? It's someplace that's beautiful. It's hard to, so I always talk about Marshall Field in Chicago, which is now a Macy's. But when Marshall Field opened, the ceiling is actually designed, it's gold-plated and designed by Tiffany & Company, right? So this is the type of luxury and excesses that are part of the department store. So simply being in that space, you know, creates a certain psychology and feeling of sometimes superiority, prestige, all of these things.
So how did the department store or department store workers get pulled into the actual civil rights movement? What's the connection?
So it's interesting. So for many places, especially, so there's certainly differences between the North and the South, I should say. But in the South, I think, is more notable for people with the sit-in movement. And so we typically think of the sit-in movement as these students, these young, brave, respectable, right, well-dressed students going in and sitting in at these lunch counters. And what my research has found is that in sitting at these lunch counters, they start to talk to the black workers in these stores. So it's not simply department stores on the scale of like a Macy's, but also these five and dime or discount department stores such as Woolworths. And as they're talking with these workers, demands start to grow. And it's not simply demands about being able to sit whenever they want and to eat in eateries, but it's also about the integration of the workforce, and not simply the integration of the workforce in some cases, but also they're demanding a certain number of workers be hired before a certain end date. So it becomes, and it's also a hidden part to some degree of the civil rights movement, because merchants didn't want it to get out that they had integrated. So oftentimes when they integrate, they do it quietly, and there's no announcement in the newspaper.
Oh my goodness. Ladies and gentlemen, we are out of time. This is the end of part two of my interview with Dr. Tracy Parker. Tune in next time for part 3.
So that was the close of my interview with Dr. Tracy Parker. She is currently working on her manuscript entitled Workers, Consumers, and Civil Rights, published by University of North Carolina Press. It's due out April of this year.
For those of you just tuning in, I'm Guy Schaefer.
And I'm Livonia Mallory, and you're listening to Hudson Mohawk Magazine on 105.3 FM. The Sanctuary.
To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or a sour bone to pick, you can text us at 518-888-3004. Also, be sure to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, a wonderful celebration of all that is creative, dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region.
Up next, we have Eleanor Stein, adjunct professor at Albany Law School, as she joins Peter Savio for the first of three segments. This segment provides an overview of the last 10 years of significant policy and legal responses to the challenges presented by increasing levels of climate disruption. The discussion includes examples of actions and inactions that at the federal level and its consequences.
Welcome to Climate Matters. This is Peter Savio, and I'm here with Eleanor Stein, an adjunct professor at Albany Law School, as well as a depth of experience with legal and regulatory issues associated with climate change and our utility and energy industries. Welcome, Eleanor.
Thank you so much. I'm thrilled to be here.
Yeah, we're very glad to have you. This is a great opportunity to talk about climate change from a more global perspective. It isn't often that we have a guest with your level of experience on international issues. Together, we're going to walk through some basics of climate change and start with that perspective and then narrow down to the national level, action, inaction, state level, and then we're going to widen it back out to some of the international issues. So thank you for being here, Eleanor.
My pleasure.
All right. So as we get started, help us out here. How did you come to play such a role? How did you come to find yourself so active in this issue?
Well, I spent a long time working for the New York Public Service Commission, which is the state agency that's responsible for regulating the energy industry. And my role there primarily was as an administrative law judge. So I would hear cases or mediate cases involving, you know, maybe utility rates or maybe larger policy issues that had to do with the major factors that were impacting the industry and its customers at any given time. And in 2004, I was assigned to preside over a case to develop something called the Renewable Portfolio Standard, which was basically code for a program, a commitment by the state of New York to introduce renewable energy at a much higher level and to require the state's utilities to purchase a certain percentage of their energy from renewable sources like wind power and solar power. And that really opened my eyes to the issues of climate change and the importance of climate change. And you may find that once you start looking into this field, you become obsessed with it because the stakes are so high and we're under such tremendous urgency. So in following years, I did other cases on similar issues. One was about energy efficiency and other forms of renewables. And then after Superstorm Sandy, I convened a collaborative of parties that were deeply interested in the causes, effects, and future of climate impacts on New York City in particular. And we formed a resilience collaborative that was part of the work of the commission to not just look at how did Con Edison and the city recover from the last storm, but long term, what were the issues that were raised about the resiliency of our energy system in a changing climate, where impacts like sea level rise and extreme heat events were going to really stress those who provide us with electricity as well as the rest of the city's infrastructure.
Mm. So a large measure of your experience being here in New York State and through the Public Service Commission as a administrative law judge and mediator on some significant cases, and then more recently, your role with Albany Law.
Well, I've been teaching climate change at Albany Law School since 2005, actually.
Ah.
I think mine was one of the first courses in the country. And now every law school teaches that course. Still, professors and lawyers will say, climate change law, that's really a thing. And yes, it's really a thing. And hopefully it's one of the things that can help us grapple with and combat the effects of climate change on our societies.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We need a number of platforms to do it, but certainly the legal platform is critical. So can you walk us through basic climate change science and some of the where we are and what we're facing in terms of global climate change?
I'd be happy to. You know, I'll start with a short conversation I had with my daughter-in-law last week. I have a 3-year-old grandson, and we were sharing how wonderful he is and so on. And she said, I just worry that by the time he's 18, he won't really have much of a life. We're destroying so much of wildlife that we live in and love. We're destroying our sources of water and food, and, you know, the ability to grow food in the world is under stress. And she went on and on. And even though I work in this field every day, I was really deeply shocked to actually think about concretely what this was going to mean for little Seneca in the near term.
In the near and long term. So this is Climate Matters, and we're having a conversation with Eleanor Stein about climate change and some of the responses and solutions. In particular, Eleanor is just speaking to us about her grandchild. And I must say, one of the perspectives on that, Eleanor, in addition to the short-term considerations of grandchildren, one observation is that children born today will very likely be alive in the 22nd century. And, you know, when it's 2100 and 2115, what they face, this is not that far away. This is your grandchild. This is my future grandchildren. This is all of our responsibility. So this isn't as far away as we're thinking.
And here's an example of that. I mean, overall, I think it's safe to say that the pace of climate change today and over the last 20 years really has consistently overtaken the projections of climate scientists, so that the changes are happening faster and on a more devastating level than was anticipated. So, for example, Greenland is melting 4 times faster than climate change experts had anticipated. The coral bleaching is far accelerated above schedule. And the warming, you know, has accelerated. So front page of today's New York Times was a report that 2018 is now considered to be the fourth hottest year since they began keeping records, which is about 140 years ago. And the last 5 years contain the 5 hottest years on the historical record. And the impacts of that are hard to imagine. So look at 2100. In the Paris Agreement, which was reached in 2015 among all the world's countries, countries pledged to take certain action to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions. And adding up all those pledges and assuming that all the countries kept them, by the end of this century, the Earth globally would be roughly 4 degrees centigrade hotter than it is today. Now, that doesn't seem like much. I mean, it's, you know, in the mid-30s today, but this morning it was much colder, and Monday it was 60 degrees. But you have to look at global temperatures. And think about this. The last ice age, which was about 12,000 years ago, at the time, there was a glacier that was more than a mile high over New York State, covered all of New York State. The temperature, the global temperature, was 6 degrees colder than it is today. So think about 6 degrees and the kind of totally catastrophic change in weather, and now think about 4 degrees by the end of this century.
Daunting perspective, but reality, and we have a responsibility to discuss it and choose how we face it. So in terms of how we face it, what do you see in terms of action and inaction at the federal level, at the state level? And this will probably just be a little bit of an introduction, and then in our next segment, we'll go into it a little deeper.
Okay. So in a nutshell, the Obama administration took very serious action on climate change, nowhere near what I would have wished. There was no action by Congress. There was no law passed, which is we're now suffering the consequences of that. But they took what have been enumerated as about 100 separate climate actions that were significant. Most significant, in my view, was the Clean Power Plan, which was aimed at reducing the carbon content of how we get electricity by about 25% to 30% by mid-century. And that, of course, is now being undone by the Trump administration.
Mm. So you're listening to Climate Matters. Our guest today is Eleanor Stein, and we're talking about the current state of affairs in terms of federal and state actions and inaction in terms of how we're responding to the threats and issues surrounding climate change. We'll be transitioning in our next couple of segments to some more in-depth discussions about regulatory and legal responses and how our society chooses to respond to these challenges. Thank you very much. Again, the Stone Age did not end because we ran out of stones.
That was Peter Savio talking to Eleanor Stein, adjunct professor at Albany Law School, talking about policy and legal responses to the challenges presented by increasing levels of climate disruption. Up next, the Spirit of the Suffragettes Summer Concert Series and Community Resource Fair will be launching alongside the 7th Annual Freedom Festival on Saturday, from June 8th to August 20th, closing with the 9th Annual Story Harvest Celebration in early September. For more information, visit tinyurl.com/suffragettespirit. Up next is Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Cassidy McCabe speaking with Deborah LaFond, Barbara Sutton, and Shelby Mack at the University of Albany in recognition of International Women's Day, as well as providing her own thoughts around social justice, activism, and feminism.
My name is Cassidy McCabe, your Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent, and in this week's Spirit of the Suffragettes, I'm giving you a listen-in on the recent public efforts at the University at Albany. As some of you may know, yesterday, March 7th, was International Women's Day. As a student at UAlbany, I was lucky enough to participate in creating an amazing banner in the university's lecture center hallway with my fellow classmates in the Global Perspectives of Women course, under the advisement of Professor Barbara Sutton from the Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies program. During the creation of this piece, I found a moment to speak with Professor Sutton, Deborah LaFond, the WGSS department bibliographer, and Shelby Mack, Professor Sutton's teaching assistant for the course and a dear friend of mine. While there, I also gave my own thoughts about what International Women's Day means to me in the moment.
Hi, my name is Deborah. International Women's Day rocks, especially at UAlbany.
Yes.
We have this incredible mural with all the students and some faculty. We're able to express what International Women's Day might mean to them today. Maybe they had several messages, maybe they had one. Mine was about water protectors and how water is in the womb, water supports all life. How do we all become water protectors? How do we support water protectors? We all need to be, you know, in that boat, so to speak. But what does International Women's Day mean to me? I grew up in the early 70s where we had a feminist movement and we were out on the streets every year marching and coming together as women, performing plays about feminism and women's rights. It means we need to learn to, you know, keep working together to respect each other and to respect all those around us, all life, really, all life. If we don't figure out how to respect all life, we'll never figure out how to decolonize power, do whatever. All life has to be respected, or we'll get it wrong again. So it means to me, international women, specifically women around the world who get very little attention on the inequities that are occurring daily, particularly people in poverty and particularly women of color and men of color, you know, are experiencing much more difficult trauma around environmental issues, around health, around war. We're dropping bombs in Somalia today. I'm very upset about that. And I know that, you know, there are women working to try to stop that and speak to that. So seeing women gather together in networks and keep moving and movements, creating movements, the Poor People's Campaign, so many different movements going on right now. We need to work together, keep them going. Black Lives Matters, so many movements. It encompasses everything. International Women's Day encompasses, you know, what it feels like to be a woman everywhere, and how do we support women everywhere in these times. So it means it's great to see women caring about this and working together to express this. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. What the International Women's Day and like this banner means to you?
All right, so this is a project I have done with my class, Global Perspectives on Women, and it is a course in which we explore many of the challenges that women face around the world, and also the progress that has been made. And for me, it is very meaningful to be able to do a project in which students bring some of what they learn, but also some of the things that they inspire them, some of the things that they want to convey and to others and raise awareness about women's issues. And to me, it's also a way to connect to my own country, which is Argentina, where International Women's Day is a very significant day of action. International Women's Day is a global day of action. So it's not like, you know, like sometimes these kind of holidays or events are commercialized, or it is really a day to raise awareness about some of the problems and some of the challenges, but also to celebrate the achievements of women, to honor women, to connect with each other, to express solidarity, and I think to give a positive message of social change. So it is meaningful for me to be able to do with my students and to connect to other women and men and people of all genders and sexualities who are trying to create a better world. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you.
My name is Shelby Mack, and International Women's Day means to me a day of celebrating women and our accomplishments and movement building around the world. So whether that's reproductive rights, trans justice, menstrual support, as well as just supporting women throughout the world. It's a day where women usually go on strike and prove to the world that that the world can't work without us. And it's also just a day to celebrate women.
Thank you.
So what does International Women's Day mean to you?
To me, it means spreading awareness, advocating for the voices that are often silenced in today's world. I see like all over here we have quotes from all sorts of different types of people that I probably wouldn't even know these quotes existed unless I saw them here. The one that sticks out to me is also how 520 million women cannot read. Or read this whole poster, which speaks volumes. I feel also warm knowing that so many people are advocating for the voices that are often silenced. Particularly trans women are often ignored in conversations about women. And I see so many statistics talking about trans women, so many statistics including trans women, as well as spreading awareness. So, yeah.
In retrospect of yesterday, I think it's important to always look at the efforts of activists on an international level and look at the intersectional impact when coming up with solutions and policies for social change. Some of the things I always push for is access to accurate and self-aware education, especially regarding ours and others' bodies, the inclusion of LGBTQ+ impact to our discussions on all fronts of activism and social rights, and the recognition of racial and class disparity in our society. To put it simply, the future is intersectional and ever-evolving. All forms of disadvantage and oppression can be connected to feminist activism, which is why it's important that all progressive activist efforts be involved in feminist discussion. For more information about this upcoming Women's Resource Fair and Summer Festival, please visit tinyurl.com/suffragettespirit and be sure to save the dates for our Summer Festival. We're launching with a 7th annual Freedom Festival on Saturday, June 8th from 3 p.m. to 6 p.m. with featured artist jazz legend Faye Victor and the Mutations for Justice. The festivals and resource fair will then continue every Tuesday, 4 to 7 p.m. from July 16th through August 20th and close with the 9th annual Story Harvest celebration on September 21st. Thank you for listening to this week's piece on the spirit of the suffragettes.
That was Cassidy McCabe speaking with Deborah LaFon, Barbara Sutton, and Shelley Mack at the University at Albany in recognition of International Women's Day. You can listen to the segment on our website and on SoundCloud. It's entitled Spirit of the Suffragette, International Women's Day. And up next, we have climate activists gathered at the state capitol on Tuesday to demand the legislature and Governor Cuomo embrace a real plan to move New York off fossil fuels by 2030, 10 years sooner than the proposed Climate and Community Protection Act. They also called for an immediate ban on approving new fossil fuel infrastructure. Alex Goldsmith spoke, Alexis Goldsmith. Spoke to Assemblyperson William Coltrane and Alex Beecham, the Northeast Region Director at Food and Water Watch, about New York off fossil fuel bill A3565.
I think number one, this bill is raising awareness to this issue, and that's a critical importance. We have a large number of sponsors in the State Assembly who are going on the bill as co-sponsors. We're in the process now this year, since the Senate is now under Democratic majority, we're now building support in the Senate. And I believe this bill can pass. I'm not sure about this year, but I would hope next year it can definitely pass, or a bill that is the equivalent of it. Sometimes bills can be passed by getting into a budget. I've done that with electronic recycling. I've done that in terms of some of the other environmental measures that I've supported. And, you know, if we can get the basic idea, the basis of this bill. See, what this bill does is it sets the guideposts that are needed in order to have a smooth transition before we have an emergency. We're running out of time. That's the problem we face. But we need to do things like address issues with environmental justice communities so they don't get caught in the emergency crisis that's coming up and get seriously injured. We need to address things like job retraining so that people who are working in the fossil industry, when this disaster, this crisis comes about, they don't end up being left out. We need to prepare in advance to do that. We need to do things like getting off fossil fuels immediately so we stop the influx of these chemicals, these contaminants, these pollutants that are getting into the air and causing the problem that we face. This bill sets up the guideposts, and it sets up regional as well as statewide advisory councils, task force, to make the plans that need to be made to have a smooth transaction. So we're trying to get this passed so we don't end up with emergency crisis where people are going to get hurt and people are going to get left behind, especially environmental justice communities are going to get particularly hurt and left behind if we don't act.
Where do these guideposts differ from those in the CCPA?
They're very similar to it, but the idea is we got to get it implemented. The main difference is that we have 2030 as the deadline. 2030, 100% renewable energy, or fossil fuels, stop the greenhouse emissions into the atmosphere. So we act much more quickly.
And how does this bill address the transportation sector?
I think it does deal with it because one of the things that we have to do in terms of transportation, for example, this bill talks about electric cars. This bill talks about setting up, you know, the infrastructure. One of the things, if you want to have electric cars, is you have to have charging stations. So the bill sets up these regional and statewide councils that will make the plans for doing things like constructing that infrastructure. We have to encourage, this bill would eliminate non-electric cars by 2030. That's very ambitious, but it can be done. The technology is there. Right now, the industry is developing storage batteries that are rechargeable, that they can recharge as the car is going. That's the biggest problem with electric cars right now. The technology is very close to doing that. So with this kind of a deadline, I believe the industry will meet that deadline and we can start getting rid of electric cars, getting rid of gas-operated cars by 2030.
And how would it help people transition to electric cars? Would it give them financial assistance?
That's one of the things that the regional and the state planning councils would have to consider. It would also set up funding so that we would have funds to be able to make decisions like that, to give abatements, to give assistance for people to use electric cars, for people to have solar paneling in their roofs and have, you know, fields, farms, solar farms on their farms, regenerative farming. It would give them incentives to do that. But it has to be done in a systematic way, in a planned way, rather than just face an emergency and then make all kinds of decisions that are going to hurt a lot of people because we haven't planned it out.
Now, you said you might not get this passed until next year. Do you think it would be wise to pass the CCPA in the meantime and then maybe override that?
I would not have a problem with that, very honestly, because I think that we have to do something right away. Mm-hmm. And we can always, you know, once we get the foot in the door, we can always make additional changes. But we can't compromise on the off fossil fuels. Mm-hmm. We keep building infrastructure that has basically a fossil structure to it, then we're putting back the amount of time that's going to take in order to get off fossil fuels and to stop the hemorrhaging that exists right now. So, you know, yes, we could pass another bill, we could take some small steps in the meantime, but what we can't compromise is we got to get off fossil fuels immediately.
So would this bill prevent new fossil fuel infrastructure from being built?
Yes,
like, say, new pipelines?
It would, because of the deadlines it imposes and the task force that it creates, that they would have the ability to make that kind of a decision and to enforce that kind of a decision. And that's what, you know, we need to do immediately.
And people have brought up jurisdiction issues with aviation because that's federally regulated. Does it have any measure for that area?
There's going to be problems in terms of dealing with an area that is under primary federal jurisdiction. We can influence it, but we're going to need the cooperation ultimately of the federal government at some point, and it better be soon because, again, we are running out of time. But yes, we are limited, you know, as a state to what a state is able to do. But again, it sets benchmarks, it sets task force, advisory councils, climate change councils that can begin to make decisions that can influence even what federal government or other states might have to do.
And what is the name of this bill?
This bill is A3565.
Alex Beecham, I'm the Northeast Region Director at Food and Water Watch. And today we're here in support of Assemblyman Colton's bill to move New York off fossil fuels. We think this is the most aggressive climate legislation in front of both houses of the legislature. We need to move off fossil fuels, and we can't wait till the middle of this century to do it. We need to move much, much faster, and that's why we're standing here today to urge the legislature to do that.
And you guys were chanting, stop the dam scam. What's
yeah.
the dam scam?
The fracked gas power plant proposal in Newburgh called the Dan Scammer, like D-A-N-S-K-A-M-M-E-R. So this is really early in the process. Governor Cuomo has the power to stop it, and if we're serious about hitting any of the state's climate goals, we think step one of that has to be stopping. We can no longer afford to build new fossil fuel infrastructure anywhere in the state. And if we're going to build massive fracked gas power plants, we don't have a prayer of hitting any of our climate goals.
Mm-hmm. Has this already passed the public hearing phase?
No, it's really early. So it's going through the Article 10 process. So the company just filed. There's a public comment period through March 15th. There's going to be multiple steps of the process where the state could kill it. And ultimately, the decision maker is really going to be Governor Cuomo. So either he'll decide to kill it or not.
Has it already gone through the secret process?
No, so it's going through Article 10, which is sort of like separate from that, right? So some of these plants, including renewable plants, go through that process instead. So it's sort of like a parallel but separate thing, if that makes sense.
So one of the things of hydrofracking is it removes large amounts of water from the environment.
As Food and Water Watch, we've cared about that for years, right? It requires massive water withdrawals, and you don't get a lot of that water back, right? A lot of it is contaminated forever, and you have to find ways to dispose of it, but it's forever gone from that watershed. So for sure, that's a giant issue, and an even bigger issue out west where water is obviously scarcer, but it's an issue everywhere.
So I know fracking is really confusing to sure. a lot of people. Do you think you could explain it in just as basic terms?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, fracking is this technique to get either oil or natural gas. In New York, it would have been natural gas, and in neighboring Pennsylvania, they're fracking for gas right now. So basically, you take massive amounts of water laced with chemicals, and you shoot it into the ground at really high speed, and then it breaks or fractures the rock. That's where the name comes from. And then either the oil or the natural gas comes up. There are huge worries about water contamination and real horror stories from Pennsylvania and elsewhere. One of the reasons New York banned it years ago, we think that was the right decision by Governor Cuomo, obviously. But the problem is now in New York, we're more reliant on fracked gas than ever before. So while we banned the actual extraction, we're using more and more and more of it. That obviously hurts our neighbors in Pennsylvania and elsewhere, but also has a huge climate impact. And if we're serious about getting off fossil fuels, we can't just swap out coal for natural gas. We have to get off all of it.
And is this a New York company?
The Dance Camera Company? It is, mm-hmm. Yes.
What is the Williams pipeline?
Yeah, so Williams is this massive fracked gas pipeline that would go from Pennsylvania through New Jersey and then through New York Harbor, so like south of Staten Island, and then ultimately would connect to an existing pipeline in the Rockaways. So this poses huge risk to the water there, and as all of these projects, we think just from a sheer climate perspective, the governor ought to reject it. Interestingly, the governor's rejected several big gas pipelines since the ban on fracking, and so we hope that he does the same on Williams. But the decision is coming fast, right? He has to decide this May, so it's sort of like crunch time. We need to convince him to do it. So yeah, it's sort of in the heat of it right now.
Have you gotten any response?
No, none. So there's been a DC hearing last week, and there's actually one tomorrow in the Rockaways. The one last week is in Bay Ridge in Brooklyn. I will say I was at the one in Bay Ridge, and in the evening session, there was literally one person who testified in support of it and several hours of people testifying against it. So I think that is hopeful, but we haven't heard anything real from the governor.
Right. It seems like there may be more motivation than just the public comment.
Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, there's a massive campaign on the other side. Williams is spending a lot of money. I mean, ultimately, this fight, like so many others, is going to boil down to whether our people are stronger than the industry's money. We think that they are, but we'll see, right? So that's sort of the thing. We'll work as hard as we can between now and May, and the hope is you can push Cuomo to do the right thing.
And how can people get involved with Food and Water Watch?
Yes, you can go to our website, which is foodandwaterwatch.org. On the Williams Pipeline fight, there's stopthewilliamspipeline.org.
And do you have any more protests coming up?
So there's that the hearing tomorrow in the Rockaway, as I mentioned. There is a big planned press conference at City Hall where a bunch of local elected officials who are opposed to the Williams Pipeline will speak out against it. That's March 15th, which also happens to be the comment deadline for the DEC comments. And then, yeah, we'll continue to have stuff in Albany, you know, going forward.
That was Alexis Goldsmith speaking to Assemblyperson William Colton and Alex Beecham, the Northeast Region Director of Food and Water Watch, about the New York Off Fossil Fuel Bill, A-3565. Guy, guess what?
Oh, no.
That concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Livonia Mallory.
And I'm Guy Schaefer. Remember to tune back in tomorrow and every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get that dose through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page. Also, be sure to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, a wonderful celebration of all that is creative, dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region.
As a reminder, WOOC 105.3 is produced by local volunteers like Guy, mm-hmm. me, and Alexis Goldsmith, who just jumped in to engineer for us. Thank you. Woo-hoo-hoo. If you're interested in volunteering with us, shoot us an email at infomediasanctuary.org, or just stop by one of our weekly meetings on Monday night at 7:07 p.m., held right here at the Sanctuary for Independent Media. Until next time, folks,
thanks for tuning in.